From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In the Soviet Union, they can actually knock down the statues of right, Lenin and Stalin, but what can you do to Mount Rushmore? they really ought to make the statues of national leaders biodegradable.
Howard Zinn, the People's Historian of the United States, talks about real heroes and the stories the corporate media refuses to cover. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Police opened fire on thousands of anti-government demonstrators at a Jakarta University campus, killing six and wounding more than a dozen others in the bloodiest outbreak of violence yet in Indonesia's growing political crisis. Witnesses said police fired down from an overpass for several minutes on protesters at the prestigious Trisakti University, inflicting the first student deaths in nearly 3 months of demonstrations at campuses across the country, calling for an end to the authoritarian government of the dictator Suharto. Weeping students gathered outside the morgue at Jakarta's Sumbawaras Hospital, where officials said four corpses with gunshot wounds had been taken. This according to the Reuters News Service. Police and military officials later confirmed that six people had died in the melee and that at least 16 had been wounded. In Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said in a statement, the United States deplores the killings and for the first time called publicly for political reform in Indonesia. This after last week when the U.S. Clinton administration pushed through $1 billion in loan guarantees for Indonesia without any human rights conditions. A defiant India conducted two more underground nuclear tests in the desert today, just days after setting off three blasts that outraged the world. In a statement, the government said its testing is now complete and it's prepared to consider a ban on such nuclear testing. India has refused to sign a global test ban treaty approved by the United Nations in 1996, arguing it froze the advantage held by nations like the United States and France that had already tested and refined sophisticated nuclear weapons. On Monday, after the first tests were conducted, the government indicated India was prepared to reopen talks on the comprehensive test ban treaty, but this time as a nuclear state. In response, President Clinton has ordered economic sanctions, including a cutoff in U.S. assistance to India, though precise details are still unclear. This news from Lebanon. Israeli warplanes attacked a training camp for Palestinians in eastern Lebanon early today, killing eight and wounding at least 20 as they slept. This according to Lebanese security officials. The night raid was the deadliest by Israeli warplanes since a 16-day Israeli aerial and ground bombing blitz of Lebanon killed at least 175 people in April of 1996. Iraq sanctions challenge delegates held an angry demonstration outside the United States interest section in downtown Baghdad yesterday. Close to 100 delegates participated in the protests. They were demanding an end to the U.S.-led United Nations sanctions that have killed more than 1.5 million Iraqi people. Delegates chanted, U.S. hands off Iraq, and 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your racist war. 5, 6, 7, 8, we will not participate. Signs and banners reading, money for tuition, not war, and end sanctions on Iraq, hum from the sides of their buses. Delegates carried protest signs from their own areas of the United States to show the diversity of the group. The group, which brought $4 million in medical aid, returns to the United States tonight. It was led by Detroit Bishop Thomas Gumbelton and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. The U.S. Senate voted overwhelmingly yesterday to restore food stamps to 250,000 legal immigrants after conservatives failed to derail the measure on grounds that it amounted to a retreat from welfare reform. and two former executives of Texaco, Inc., who had been taped discussing the destruction of documents demanded in a racial discrimination lawsuit against the company, were found not guilty yesterday on charges they tried to obstruct justice. Lawyers for Richard Lundwall, the man who secretly recorded the meetings, and Robert Ulrich, the former treasurer of the big oil company, said the acquittals vindicated their arguments that the two had done nothing illegal. But the verdict by the jury of 8 men and 4 women in a federal court in White Plains stunned and angered civil rights leaders who said it was based on technicalities and sent a disturbing message about permissible behavior by corporate officers. And a federal judge in Oklahoma City rejected a plea for leniency for Michael Fortier, the man who never warned the authorities about the Oklahoma City bombing 3 years ago, but who later became a leading government witness against the 2 men who were convicted. The judge indicated that he might impose a harsher sentence on Fortier than the 11 to 14 years suggested by prosecutors. Fortier has pleaded guilty to failing to warn officials of the plot, to lying to the FBI, and to 2 charges involving the transportation of stolen firearms. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. No other historian has attacked the distortions and myths about the history of the United States as forcefully as Howard Zinn. His book, A People's History of the United States, tells history not from the perspective of the victors, but rather through the voices of the victims. A People's History has become standard text in the struggle for justice in this country. Zinn has said that because history is not neutral, neither should historians be. He himself has been arrested numerous times for anti-war actions and other demonstrations, and has testified at several civil disobedience trials in this country on the importance of breaking unjust laws. Today on Democracy Now!, we want to play for you a powerful speech Zinn gave just a few weeks ago at the Project Censored Awards in New York City, awards given to journalists who wrote groundbreaking stories left almost untouched by the corporate media. Howard Zinn was the keynote speaker at the Project Censored Awards ceremony.
Well, thanks for inviting me here. Not everybody invites me. I was thinking about the common situation of journalists and historians, and about the fact that both of us, both groups, are always exhorted to be professional and not to get emotional and not to get involved in what we do. Not long ago, I came across a book which was written for college professors called The Art and Politics of College Teaching. It's a kind of Machiavellian guide to success in the academic world. But it could also be a guide to success in the world of journalism. And it's written in the form of questions. Question number 9, can I involve myself in causes, crusades, and political activism? Answer, be leery of introducing your political conclusions or social thought. Be on guard not to take sides. Play dumb. I've tried. But so we, all of us are really not just journalists and historians, but, you know, all of us who are in the world, you know, always, whatever we're doing, we are urged to be neutral. And to be neutral in an unneutral world, that is, to be neutral in a world where things are already happening, that is, children are already going hungry, wars are going on, and terrible things are going on, and you can't, to be neutral in a world like that is to collaborate with whatever is happening. And we don't want to, the people we're honoring here tonight have chosen not to collaborate. We're very often told that we must only give facts. I remember during the, I don't know if you can remember back that far in history, to that presidential race, and Dole spoke to the American Legion. Sometimes I mention the word Dole and people look at me quizzically. Dole, who's that? Dole, yes. Dole, pineapple, right? Dole. I remember Dole spoke to the American Legion. He was very upset, which made me feel good, of course, upset about the new history that's being taught. You know, people are beginning to teach history in a new way. And he said, let's not have these interpretations. Let's just have facts. Just facts. Those of you who read Charles Dickens' novel Hard Times may remember Gradgrind, the stereotype of a school teacher. Oh, well, sometimes I wonder, was he really a stereotype or was he a real school teacher? Which that thought bothered me. But he would say to his students, just give me facts, you know, only facts. But of course there's no such thing as just a fact. Behind every fact is a judgment. And the judgment is made as to whether this fact is important enough to be presented. And at the same time, another judgment is made, and that is that there are facts that are not going to be presented. There are facts that, that leave people where they are, except maybe sleepier. And there are other facts that excite people to indignation, so, and maybe to action. Those are the facts that are exposed by the people who whose stories are read by Project Censored, and who are here tonight, and many, you know, who are not here tonight. So I'm very glad that tribute is being paid to them. They're really part of a long tradition of people who tell stories that have not been told. When I say a long tradition, I mean going back to the 15th century. It's dangerous to invite a historian to speak. You know, he'll start with Egypt. You know, I remember my high school teacher saying, "Why do we study history? To understand the present." Then he'd start with Egypt. You know, he'd get up to World War I. You know, forgive me. I think of the Columbus story. No. And I think of what was omitted in the Columbus story that was told to generation after generation of students in this country. The same story over and over again. And of what was omitted. Bartolomé de las Casas blew the whistle on Columbus. They didn't use that phrase in those days, I guess, and especially Spanish priests didn't use that phrase, but that's what he did. He told the story of what Columbus and his men did to the natives of Hispaniola. Told about the mutilations and the kidnappings and the murders. And the information has been available all these years, because Las Casas wrote book after book about this, but it was ignored. Recently there's begun to be a change in the telling of that story, and in 1992, when the quincentennial of celebration took place, for the first time in Columbus Day celebrations, there were protests all over the country and counter-celebrations. And today, thousands of teachers are teaching the Columbus story in a different way, having broken through that censorship of the Columbus story. I read the paper that a friend of mine who teaches on the West Coast and who was a sort of pioneer in spreading the word about Columbus to other teachers. I read a paper that one of his students wrote to him. Her name was Rebecca. And she said, now that I know all this about Columbus, I wonder, what else have I been lied to about, you see? And that's the important thing about bringing out stories that haven't been told, that is not only to inform people of something that is very, very significant and that they are not being told about, something that might lead them to make connections with other issues, you know. Because the Columbus story is not just a matter of remedying the historical story about Columbus, it's a matter of thinking about progress, thinking about dehumanization, thinking about greed, and thinking, and I guess maybe more important than anything, yes, thinking about what has been left out of all the stories that have been told to us. And there are other examples like that. Well, there are many examples, and I'll just list a few. But Peter mentioned Charles Beard. It's interesting. I haven't heard the name of Charles Beard mentioned in a long time, and here I come here, you know, and I thought, I'm going to spring the name of Charles Beard on this group. And Peter did it. But Beard, after all, there's a story that was censored for a long time about the Constitution and the making of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. And, well, you were not supposed to say anything bad about the Founding Fathers. I mean, just to give them that title, Founding Fathers, it makes any criticism of them seem like patricide. And so you're not, the Founding Fathers, and it's true, they were smart. And also handsome and well-dressed, you know. But when Beard in 1913 wrote An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, he pointed out, just very calmly, having gone into the records of the Treasury Department and so on, that these 55 men did not simply, you know, out of the kindness of their heart, draw up a document that would be great for all people. No, these men had interests. And in writing this Constitution, they were serving the interests of bondholders and slaveholders and manufacturers and... if they were writing a constitution that would maintain the status quo, they were writing a constitution that was a reaction to Shays' rebellion in Massachusetts, a constitution that would keep things stabilized and prevent future insurrections. And that process of omission of that story and trying to correct that omission has been going on throughout American history. In 1987, when we were celebrating the bicentennial of the Constitution, again, this enormous wave of self-congratulation of the Founding Fathers, the Constitution, and Ronald Reagan. I keep mentioning these names that I thought maybe people have forgotten. And I always thought, well, maybe people will remember the airport. But Ronald Reagan wrote an essay that year of the bicentennial. Ronald Reagan wrote an essay about, it's hard to believe, but he did. He wrote an essay about the Constitution. It was published in one of the scholarly journals, a Parade magazine. And in it, Reagan said, this Constitution, such a perfect work, it could only have been done by the guiding hand of God. Well, what can you say after that? During that bicentennial year, in this wave of adulation of this marvelous document, there was one dissenting voice in higher circles. And that dissenting voice was a Supreme Court justice, the one black Supreme Court justice, Thurgood Marshall, who in the midst of all of this spoke up and said, now wait a while, about celebrating the Founding Fathers and the Constitution. You're celebrating a document that legitimized slavery. He was trying to correct the record.
Historian Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States, will be back with him in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the speech of historian Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States and his memoir, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. He was speaking in New York City just a few weeks ago at the Project Censored Awards ceremony.
But there was another story told over and over again in the history of this country, told in classrooms, and that's how I remember the story of the great economic miracle of the United States becoming a great industrial power. In that period between the Civil War and World War I, you know, the United States did astounding things in the growth of the economy, of industry, and the railroads spanning the country, and the steel mills, and the mines, and there were the heroes of this economic revolution. I remember we read about and heard about again and again Carnegie and Rockefeller and Vanderbilt and Harriman and Stanford and all the rest. But something was omitted. You know, what was omitted was the story of the people who worked in those mills, the girls who went to work in the textile mills of New England at the age of 12 and died at the age of 25, or the Chinese and Irish immigrants who worked on the railroads and who got sick in the heat and people who worked in Rockefeller's oil refineries. That story was somehow left out. And at the turn of the century, before the turn of the century, we began to get voices that tried to fill in that story, voices that tried to break through that censorship. We have 35,000 populist orators going around the country trying to tell people about how in the midst of this great economic miracle, the farmers of this country were suffering. And then we began to get the writings of Upton Sinclair and John Reed and Emma Goldman and Helen Keller, whose membership in the Socialist Party was censored out of the stories, those glorious stories told about her in all the classrooms of the country about this handicapped woman who had risen to great heights, but nothing about the fact that Helen Keller was a socialist and somebody who walked on picket lines and somebody who spoke out and wrote about what she called social deafness and industrial blindness. And that problem of filling in the story and counteracting the official story of economic miracles has continued throughout American history. In the 1920s, it was the jazz age and the age of prosperity, and everybody was doing fine. I mean, just recently I saw on television There was a program on the 20s, and the narrator said, "The road." This is an exact quote, and I don't usually give exact quotes, but this was so dear to me. The road to riches was wide open to everyone in the 20s, and I had done work on Fiorello LaGuardia when he was a congressman in the 20s in East Harlem, representing poor people at East Harlem. And I read the letters that his constituents from East Harlem wrote to him. And the letters were all about, my husband is out of work. My kids don't have enough to eat. They've turned off the gas. But there were stories like this not only in East Harlem, but all over the country. Under that surface of prosperity in the 1920s, there were people in distress all over the country. And of course, that all came crashing down as shaky edifices tend to do. And today we're going through the same thing. The president gets on there before the television cameras and announces, oh, the country is in great economic shape, and he gives you the figures, and you know, and everybody, and the Dow Jones average has gone up. And it's all, the word is used again, the economy is good. And the economy is something that embraces everybody. You know, we all have the same interests. You know, I and Exxon have the same interests. You know. And, you know, the economy is sort of, Kurt Vonnegut used the word in one of his books, invented the word, I guess, strange, that a writer should invent a word. Grand Falloon, a sort of a kind of great bubble of something which embraces everything, and it needs to be sort of punctured in order to get at the complex truth. And you know, today it's the Dow Jones average. All you have to do is look at the Dow Jones average, which we're told about every single day, every single night, as if that's how you know how people are living. You want to know how people are living in Harlem? You don't want to know how people are living in the Roxbury district of Boston and the south side of Chicago and Appalachia? The Dow Jones average. Yes. But there are people today who are breaking through that and who are trying to tell the other story, the kind of people who are represented in the Project Censored Awards. And I think of, well, I think of people like Jim Hightower and people like Barbara Ehrenreich and Francis Piven and Richard Cloward, people telling about the others who are not represented in that very happy story, you know, about the economy. There's another kind of story I became aware of, I was just thinking about recently, because it's 100 years after the Spanish-American War. I don't know if you're celebrating. It was a great war, as you know. It was called the Splendid Little War. Few casualties. Does that sound familiar? Few American casualties. We don't count the others, right? Only a few hundred American casualties in the military as a result of the war itself, which only lasted a few months. Thousands of American casualties due to poisoned beef supplied to the soldiers by the meatpacking companies of Chicago. I know we're not accustomed to profit entering and leading to the loss of human life, but as it happened in the Spanish-American War. But there's an untold story, because in school in books in the classes, they told us about this great moment in Theodore Roosevelt riding up, you know, San Juan Hill with the Rough Riders and then that took a certain amount of important space in the history books. And then a very tiny bit of space was allotted to one of the most censored stories of the 20th century, the story of the American conquest of the Philippines. The Spanish-American, the war in Cuba lasted a few months, the war in the Philippines lasted for 8 years. And a brutal war, full of atrocities, in many ways a precursor of the Vietnam War. But there were people who pointed this out, people who spoke up, people who tried to break through the censorship. One of them was Mark Twain. When a massacre took place in 1906 in the southern Philippines, a massacre of the Moros, the Muslims living in the southern islands of the Philippines, and the U.S. Army attacked these 600 Moros who were sort of living in the hollow of a mountain, men, women, and children. They attacked them, killed every single one of them. And Mark Twain pointed to this. He pointed to the congratulatory letter that President Theodore Roosevelt sent to the colonel who was in charge of this military operation. Theodore Roosevelt, of course, is up there on Mount Rushmore. I've tried to avoid South Dakota for years. Because, I mean, in the Soviet Union, they can actually knock down the statues of right, Lenin and Stalin, but what can you do to Mount Rushmore? You know, they really ought to make the statues of national leaders biodegradable. But there's one important set of stories that perhaps is the most censored kind of story in the United States today. And that is the story of those people who are resisting. Those people all over the country who are not accepting what is going on. The people who know that there's something corrupt and wrong about the political system. People who know that beneath the talk of the sound economy, there's a kind of sickness which you can tell if you just look at the fact that 1/4 or 1/5 of the children in the country are living in poverty, or that we have more people in prison than any other country in the world, that there must be some sickness in the society that is represented by that. And there are people who understand this, and the people who are organizing, people resist this. I go around the country, and wherever I go, however small the town, there are always people, organized individuals, who are doing things, who are concerned, who are indignant about what is going on, who are acting. You know, you don't hear about them because they don't appear in the media. And so people in one part of the country don't know what's happening in another part of the country. I mean, I go to Duluth, Minnesota, because I'm proud of having gone to Duluth, Minnesota. Duluth, Minnesota, it's a gathering like this of 300 or 400 people in Duluth, Minnesota, and there in the back of the room there are 12 tables, each representing a different organization in Duluth, which is working on women's rights or militarization or the problems of daycare centers or, really. And you can multiply this around the country. I go to Athens, Georgia, which I remember from when I lived in Atlanta Athens, the seat of the Confederacy. Athens, Georgia was a place you talked about in hushed tones. And here, I was there when the bombing of Iraq seemed to be about to happen. And I spoke about that to a group of about 500 people in Athens, Georgia, and it seemed that everybody there agreed with me. And there in Athens, Georgia, there was a progressive bookstore, and there was a radical columnist on the major newspaper of Athens, Georgia, and there was an annual human rights festival in Athens. I was in Asheville, North Carolina, and they told me about how a few days before, the Ku Klux Klan had called a rally in Asheville. 28 people showed up for the Ku Klux Klan rally. 1,000 citizens of Asheville showed up to protest the Ku Klux Klan rally, you see. So, you know, I'm in Tallahassee, Florida, and the students there tell me that they have a project in which they are helping people in a nearby factory, you know, working in a mushroom factory, and people who are immigrants and working for low wages and trying to unionize, and they're trying to help them unionize their plant. All over this country, there are things like that going on that we don't hear about and that the press doesn't tell us about. When I was in Olympia, Washington, I suddenly seem to be boasting about all the places that I've been at, you know. I'm at all these glamorous places. Yeah, some people talk about going to Italy and, you know, the Micronesia and so on, and, well, Duluth. It's mine, and there's a kind of network of information which a kind of counter media of community newspapers, of community radio stations, Radio Pacifica, David Barsamian's alternative radio, you know. Roger Leisner and Radio Free Maine, and I started to say I was in Olympia, Washington, and there I learned it, and you maybe learn about things years. They told me that during the Gulf War, 3,000 people in Olympia, which is the state capital, you know, Washington. 3,000 people in Olympia marched to the state capitol, went inside and occupied the state capitol in protest against the Gulf War. Nobody in any part of the country ever heard of it. However, they discovered that there had been an Italian television crew present that day, and 4 hours of that event appeared on Italian television. You see. There are things happening in the culture which are not represented, but which are there. And I think of Michael Moore's films, you know, being seen by millions of people. I think of Our Bodies, Ourselves being read by millions of people in this country, and so all of this is beneath that sort of nice surface of placidity and contentment and the Dow Jones average. I was asked a couple of years ago, the Philadelphia Inquirer asked me to review a book on Vietnam. And, well, I was interested because the book was written by a conservative who I knew was against the anti-war movement. And so in a kind of state of masochism, I decided, yes, I'll review the book. Well, it was interesting to me, because in this book, he said, President Bush thinks that the Vietnam syndrome, you know, the Vietnam syndrome, which is looked upon as a kind of sickness, as that people developed a revulsion against war, that's very sick. You know, and that the Vietnam syndrome, Bush had said, the Vietnam syndrome is buried forever in the sands of the Arabian Peninsula. A real poet. And this writer said, no, that's not true. That's not true at all. He wrote in a very worried way, he said, there is a permanent adversarial culture in this country. And he was sort of warning his fellow conservatives about this, a permanent adversarial culture. And I think that's true. And that culture, who knows where it will lead? Because that's what happens Before important changes take place, things happen underneath the surface, and things develop, and at a certain point in history, and you don't know when, things come together, and you get a national movement, and change takes place. The people we are honoring here tonight, and I would guess the people in this room, and millions of people in this country, are part of that promising, permanent adversarial culture. So that's something to feel good about. Thank you.
Activist. He's authored numerous books, including A People's History of the United States and his memoir, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. He was speaking recently in New York City at the Project Censored Awards. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. May is the month for the Clio Awards, the Oscars of commercials, when the advertising industry pays tribute to its most artful and accomplished commercials. Well, on the eve of the ad industry's event, the second annual Schmio Awards ceremony was held, honoring advertisers' dubious achievements. The theme of the evening was Kids for Sale. Among the presenters was activist and comedian Dick Gregory. The event was hosted by New York University professor and media critic Neil Postman.
You may wish to imagine a connection between our event and what is called the Clios. The Clio Awards, which will be held tomorrow and Thursday evening, not far from here, exist for the purpose of celebrating the achievements of the advertising profession, and in particular to emphasize the role advertising plays in contributing positively to American culture. Now, many people believe that the Schmios are held to ridicule that presumption, and I'll leave it to you to judge if that is true. But speaking of presumptions, I should remind you that before the advertising industry claimed her, Clio was known as the muse of history, not, as some people think, the muse of duplicity. The muse of history. Now, think on that. In other words, the advertising industry's choice of a name for their awards is even stranger than ours. Now, the theme of this year's Schmios is children, and we selected this theme to dispute the obscene assumption held so firmly by some advertisers that children are merely markets. Customers to fuel the economy. The education of children is the most serious business of a culture, to be carried on continuously by parents, by teachers, by clerics. In America, it's also carried on by advertisers. By age 20, average American youngsters have already seen about 500,000 TV commercials alone. So that their conception of what is good, true, and beautiful is profoundly influenced by those people who will give themselves Clio Awards later this week. So it's necessary for us to ask, what are the conceptions of the good, the true, and the beautiful that these people promote? Do they tell the young that the surest way to earn God's favor is to buy things? Well, of course they do. Do they tell the young that all problems are solvable, and solvable fast, and solvable through the agency of technology? Well, of course. Do they tell the young that the worst possible thing one can do is to delay gratification? Well, they tell them that daily and in a thousand ways. The good people who are assembled here this evening to give Shmio Awards have as their purpose calling attention to the messages that are being sent to our young by a large and powerful industry. I suspect that when you hear what they say and see what they show, you'll find some of it amusing. But it is amusing only in the sense that seeing one slip on a banana peel is amusing. That is to say, it is a disaster. What we have here tonight is a kind of town meeting of citizens who are concerned about the kind of people our children will be. Our first four presentations are general awards, after which all the others will concern our special awards section, which we call Kids for Sale. It is my great pleasure to introduce comedian, author, civil rights activist, Dick Gregory.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Speaking of advertising, I've been taking that Viagra. You know, everybody's talking about the side effects, but the one they missed is him 98-year-old retired sex maniacs would be reactivated now. You know, I keep listening to debates of violence and drive-by shootings and what's the most violent neighborhood in the world, and people start selling their land, moving out to the suburbs and white neighborhoods. I'm going back now just rebuying all the land in the ghettos, because after what happened in the Vatican and Jonesboro, it looked like the ghetto's the safest place to live. Say, well, the number one killer drive-by shooting? No, the number one killer in America is cigarettes. 495,000 Americans die every year from smoking cigarettes. That's about 19% of the deaths. The number two cause of death in America, bad diet and inactivity. 300,000, 14% of death. The number three cause of death is alcohol. Firearms is number two. Illegal drugs is number one. So I tell black folks who's scared to come out and sitting in the buildings, don't want to do nothing, worried about being killed, just sitting in the house, smoking their cigarettes, eating their barbecue ribs, not doing no exercise, drinking their light beer, they participating in the top three killers. And I've always tried to, you know, steer people into the right health, particularly black folks. I know last 4th of July in Chicago, I went out to a picnic with all these black folks. Well, try to talk about good health. You know, anytime I see just one black dude, he's about 22 years old, sleep, drunk out of his mind on cheap wine, mouth open, flies going in and out of his mouth. Got cocaine dust on his nose, reefer in his beard. I woke him up and say, here's an apple. He said, is it organic? You know. I'm here tonight to give the There Go My Neighborhood Award. There goes my neighborhood. Billboards are like $1.1 billion business. And almost 25% of that revenue is derived from two industries, alcohol and tobacco. And a disproportionate number of billboards is in the African American community and the Latino neighborhoods. On street corners, near homes, schools, parks, churches, and where children are confronted day after day after day after day with this filth. Like drug dealers, they claim alcohol, cigarettes will bring happiness, good sex, more power. Strangers might conclude that the language of the ghetto is not rap, but billboards. And communicate they do. According to the White House, smoking among black teenagers have doubled in the 1990s. One billboard company executive wanted to know what it would take a Compton community leader, Chris Bailey, to stop pushing for billboard bans. I'll back off if you put the same type of billboards in Beverly Hills that you put in Compton, she replied. And the executive replied, but there are no billboards in Compton. She grinned and said, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And so alcohol and cigarette billboards speak a very special language in there. In this case, it's like patronizing slang. And just like other drug dealers, they promise immediate payoffs. Not just in flavor, they promise instant happiness. They promise men great sex. I mean, even Latino men, they promise, hey, great sex, and hey, and if you can't get the woman, old dude, take these guns. Not only do billboards sell malt liquor as a quick drink, quick high, more powerful, higher than anything you've been able to put into your body, a more powerful beer than just regular beer. But they also appeal to the powerless. They sell all of these things to the powerless people and say, here, this will give you more power. But to rich folks, power might mean the ability to make deals, to influence elections, or at least to exercise control over your own life, your own life. According to the old English, for the poor, power means getting drunk and losing control. But cities are fighting back. Compton, Chicago, Inglewood, Baltimore, they have passed ordinances restricting alcohol and cigarette billboards where children are exposed to them. And other cities, including San Francisco, Oakland, New York, have restricted cigarette billboards. And whether we like it or not, and whether they like it or not, I think we're kind of winning. But despite these ordinances, the billboards have remained. In some cases, billboards, alcohol companies have fought these restrictions tooth and nail. For example, in Baltimore, Baltimore passed an ordinance 4 years ago in early 1994 that said billboard companies kept dragging their feet. They kept suing, going to court, appealing, refusing to take the billboards down. When Universal Outdoors billboard finally was due to come down at the expiration of their contract, they extended their contracts literally the night before the contract was due to expire. That's why I'm giving my There Go My Neighborhood award to stonewalling, bullying, double dealing, and otherwise resisting efforts to clean up the block to Universal Outdoor. You got it. You got it. But trust me, things are not all bad. Only 10 days ago, this past Friday, in Baltimore, 4 years after they passed their ordinance, that liquor billboard finally was covered over. Baltimore is the first city in America to succeed in bringing them down. We thank you, Baltimore, and we thank all those folks out here that have worked very hard to see to it that this will happen. And I leave you by saying this. All the decent folks out here on this planet that's working for right and to save our children, we represent light and all those other forces, regardless to how much money and how much power, they represent darkness. And if you want to know who's going to win this, when you go home tonight, go in a dark room and turn the light on and see if light don't wipe out darkness. I love you. God bless you.
Gregory at the second annual Schmio Awards, honoring advertisers' dubious achievements. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!